understood what I was doing, and I knew it was treasonous. If you fail to punish me, men will believe that we connive together to free Jaime Lannister. It was mine own act, and mine alone, and I alone must answer for it. Put me in the Kingslayer's empty irons, and I will wear them proudly, if that is how it must be.
Fetters! The very word seemed to shock poor Sir Desmond. For the king's mother, my lord's own daughter, oh, impossible.
Mayhaps, said the steward, authorized Wayne, my lady would consent to be confined to her chambers until Sir Edmure returns, a time alone to pray for her murdered sons.
Confined, aye, Sir Desmond said, confined to a tower cell that would serve.
If I am to be confined, let it be in my father's chambers, so I might comfort him in his last days.
Sir Desmond considered for a moment. Very well. You shall lack no comfort nor courtesy, but freedom of the castle is denied you. Visit the sept as you need, but elsewise remain in Lord Hurster's chambers until Lord Edmure returns.
As you wish. Her brother was no lord while their father lived, but Catelyn did not correct him. Set a guard on me, if you must, but I give you my pledge that I shall attempt no escape. Sir Desmond nodded, plainly glad to be done with his distasteful task, but sad-eyed authorized Wayne lingered a moment after the Castellan took his leave.
It was a grave thing you did, my lady, but for naught. Sir Desmond has sent Sir Robin Ryger after them to bring back the Kingslayer, or, failing that, his head.
Catelyn had expected no less. May the warrior give strength to your sword arm, Brian, she prayed. She had done all she could. Nothing remained but to hope. Her things were moved into her father's bedchamber, dominated by the great canopy bed she had been born in, its pillars carved in the shapes of leaping trout. Her father himself had been moved half a turn down the stair, his sickbed placed to face the triangular balcony that opened off his solar, from whence he could see the rivers that he had always loved so well. Lord Hurster was sleeping when Catelyn entered. She went out to the balcony and stood with one hand on the rough stone balustrade. Beyond the point of the castle, the swift tumblestone joined the placid red fork, and she could see a long way down river. If a striped sail comes from the east, it will be Sir Robin returning. For a moment the surface of the water was empty. She thanked the gods for that, and went back inside to sit with her father. Catelyn could not say if Lord Hurster knew she was there, or if her presence brought him any comfort, but it gave her solace to be with him.
"What would you say if you knew my crime, father?" she wondered. "Would you have done as I did, if it were Lysa and me in the hands of our enemies? Or would you condemn me too, and call it mother's madness?" There was a smell of death about that room, a heavy smell, sweet and foul, clinging. It reminded her of the sons she had lost, her sweet Bran, and her little Rickon, slain at the hand of Theon Greyjoy, who had been Ned's ward. She still grieved for Ned. She would always grieve for Ned. But to have her babies taken as well. "It is a monstrous, cruel thing to lose a child," she whispered softly, more to herself than to her father. Lord Hurster's eyes opened.
"Tansy,"
he husked, in a voice thick with pain. "He does not know me." Catelyn had grown accustomed to him taking her for her mother, or her sister Lysa, but Tansy was a name strange to her.
"It's Catelyn," she said. "It's Cat, father."
"Give me the blood. Oh, please, Tansy."
Could there have been another woman in her father's life, some village maiden he had wronged when he was young, perhaps? Could he have found comfort in some serving wench's arms after mother died? It was a queer thought, unsettling. Suddenly she felt as though she had not known her father at all. "Who is Tansy, my lord? Do you want me to send for her father? Where would I find the woman?" Does she still live?
Lord Hoster groaned.
Dead.
His hand groped for hers.
You will have others, sweet babes, and true-born.
Others? Catelyn thought. Has he forgotten that Ned is gone? Is he still talking to Tansy? Or is it me now, or Lysa, or Mother?
When he coughed, the sputum came up bloody. He clutched her fingers.
Be a good wife, and the gods will bless you. Sons, true-born sons.
A sudden spasm of pain made Lord Huster's hand tighten. His nails dug into her hand, and he gave a muffled scream. Maester Wyman came quickly to mix another dose of milk of the puppy and help his lord swallow it down. Soon enough, Lord Hoster Tully had fallen back into a heavy sleep. He was asking after a woman, said Cat. Tansy.
Tansy?
The maester looked at her blankly. You know no one by that name? A serving girl? A woman from some nearby village? Perhaps someone from years past? Catelyn had been gone from River Run for a very long time.
No, my lady, I can make inquiries if you like. Authorized Wayne would surely know if any such person ever served at River Run. Tansy, did you say? The small folk often name their daughters after flowers and herbs.
The maester looked thoughtful.
There was a widow, I recall. She used to come to the castle looking for old shoes in need of new soles. Her name was Tansy, now that I think on it. Or was it Pansy? Some such. But she has not come for many years.
Her name was Violet, said Catelyn, who remembered the old woman very well.
Was it? The maester looked apologetic. My pardons, Lady Catelyn, but I may not stay. Sir Desmond has decreed that we are to speak to you only so far as our duties require.
Then you must do as he commands. Catelyn could not blame Sir Desmond. She had given him small reason to trust her, and no doubt he feared that she might use the loyalty that many of the folk of River Run would still feel towards their lord's daughter to work some further mischief. I am free of the ward, at least, she told herself, if only for a little while. After the maester had gone, she donned a woolen cloak and stepped out onto the balcony once more. Sunlight shimmered on the rivers, gilding the surface of the waters as they rolled past the castle. Catelyn shaded her eyes against the glare, searching for a distant sail, dreading the sight of one. But there was nothing, and nothing meant that her hopes were still alive. All that day she watched, and well into the night, until her legs ached from the standing. A raven came to the castle in late afternoon, flapping down on great black wings to the rookery. Dark wings, dark words, she thought, remembering the last bird that had come and the horror it had brought. Maester Wyman returned at evenfall to minister to Lord Tully and bring Catelyn a modest supper of bread, cheese, and boiled beef with horseradish.
I spoke to Authorized Wayne, my lady. Is quite certain that no woman by the name of Tansy has ever been at River Run during his service.
There was a raven today, I saw. Has Jamie been taken again? Or slain? God's forbid.
No, my lady, we've had no word of the Kingslayer.
Is it another battle, then? Is Edmure in difficulty? Or Rob? Please be kind. Put my fears at rest.
My lady, I should not,
Wyman glanced about, as if to make certain no one else was in the room.
Lord Tywin has left the riverlands. All's quiet on the fords.
Whence came the raven, then?
From the west, he answered, busying himself with Lord Huster's bedclothes and avoiding her eyes.
Was it news of Rob? He hesitated.
Yes, my lady.
Something is wrong. She knew it from his manner. He was hiding something from her. Tell me, is it Rob? Is he hurt?
Not dead.
gods be good, please do not tell me that he is dead. His grace took a wound, storming the crag, Maester Wyman said, still evasive, but writes that it is no cause for concern, and that he hopes to return soon.
A wound? What sort of wound? How serious?
No cause for concern, he writes.
All wounds concern me. Is he being cared for?
I'm certain of it. The maester at the crag will tend him, I have no doubt.
Where was he wounded?
My lady, I'm commanded not to speak with you. I am sorry.
Gathering up his potions, Wyman made a hurried exit, and once again Catelyn was left alone with her father. The milk of the poppy had done its work, and Lord Huster was sunk in deep sleep. A thin line of spittle ran down from one corner of his open mouth to dampen his pillow. Catelyn took a square of linen and wiped it away gently. When she touched him, Lord Huster moaned,
"Forgive me,"
he said so softly she could scarcely hear the words.
"Tensy, blood, the blood, gods be kind."
His words disturbed her more than she could say, though she could make no sense of them.
Blood, she thought. Must it all come back to blood? Father, who was this woman? And what did you do to her that needs so much forgiveness?
That night, Catelyn slept fitfully, haunted by formless dreams of her children, the lost and the dead. Well before the break of day, she woke with her father's words echoing in her ears, "Sweet babes and true-born."
Why would he say that, unless... could he have fathered a bastard on this woman Tansy?
She could not believe it. Her brother Edmure, yes, it would not have surprised her to learn that Edmure had a dozen natural children.
But not her father, not Lord Huster Tully, never. Could Tansy be some pet name he called Lysa, the way he called me Cat?
Lord Huster had mistaken her for her sister before.
"You'll have others," he said,
"sweet babes and true-born." Lysa had miscarried 5 times, twice in the Aerie, thrice at King's Landing, but never at River Run, where Lord Huster would have been at hand to comfort her.
Never, unless she was with child that first time.
She and her sister had been married on the same day, and left in their father's care when their new husbands had ridden off to rejoin Robert's rebellion. Afterward, when their moonblood did not come at the accustomed time, Lysa had gushed happily of the son she was certain they carried. "Your son will be heir to Winterfell and mine to the Eyrie. Oh, they'll be the best of friends like your Ned and Lord Robert. There'll be more brothers and cousins, truly, I just know it." She was so happy. But Lysa's blood had come not long after, and all the joy had gone out of her. Catelyn had always thought that Lysa had simply been a little late. But if she had been with child. She remembered the first time she gave her sister Rob to hold, small, red-faced and squalling, but strong even then, full of life. No sooner had Catelyn placed the babe in her sister's arms than Lysa's face dissolved into tears. Hurriedly, she had thrust the baby back at Catelyn and fled.
If she had lost a child before, that might explain father's words, and much else besides.
Lysa's match with Lord Aaron had been hastily arranged, and John was an old man even then, older than their father. An old man without an heir. His first 2 wives had left him childless. His brother's son had been murdered with Brandon Stark in King's Landing. His gallant cousin had died in the Battle of the Bells. He needed a young wife, if House Aaron was to continue. A young wife known to be fertile. Catelyn rose, threw on a robe, and descended the steps to the darkened solar to stand over her father. A sense of helpless dread filled her. "Father," she said. "Father, I know what you did."
She was no longer an innocent bride with a head full of dreams. She was a widow, a traitor, a grieving mother, and wise, wise in the ways of the world. "You made him take her," she whispered. Lysa was the price John Aaron had to pay for the swords and spears of House Tully. Small wonder her sister's marriage had been so loveless. The Aarons were proud and prickly of their honour. Lord John might wed Lysa to bind the Tullys to the cause of the rebellion and in the hopes of a son, but it would have been hard for him to love a woman who came to his bed soiled and unwilling. He would have been kind, no doubt, dutiful, yes, but Lysa needed warmth. The next day, as she broke her fast, Catelyn asked for quill and paper and began a letter to her sister in the Vale of Arran. She told Lysa of Bran and Rickon, struggling with the words, but mostly she wrote of their father. "His thoughts are all of the wrong he did you, now that his time grows short. Maester Vyman says he dare not make the milk of the puppy any stronger. It is time for father to lay down his sword and shield. It is time for him to rest. Yet he fights on grimly, will not yield. It is for your sake, I think. He needs your forgiveness. The war has made the road from the Aire to River Run dangerous to travel, I know, but surely a strong force of knights could see you safely through the Mountains of the Moon. 100 men or 1,000? And if you cannot come, will you not write him, at least, a few words of love, so he might die in peace? Write what you will, and I shall read it to him, and ease his way." Even as she set the quill aside and asked for sealing wax, Catelyn sensed that the letter was like to be too little and too late. Maester Vyman did not believe Lord Huster would linger long enough for a raven to reach the Aire and return, though he has said much the same before. Tully men did not surrender easily, no matter the odds. After she entrusted the parchment to the maester's care, Catelyn went to the sept and lit a candle to the father above for her own father's sake, a second to the crone who had let the first raven into the world when she appeared through the door of death, and a third to the mother, for Lysa and all the children they had both lost. Later that day, as she sat at Lord Huster's bedside with a book, reading the same passage over and over, she heard the sound of loud voices and a trumpet's blare. "Sir Robin," she thought at once, flinching. She went to the balcony. There was nothing to be seen out on the rivers, but she could hear the voices more clearly from outside, the sound of many horses, the clink of armour, and here and there a cheer. Catelyn made her way up the winding stairs to the roof of the keep. "Sir Desmond did not forbid me the roof," she told herself as she climbed. The sounds were coming from the far side of the castle, by the main gate. A knot of men stood before the portcullis as it rose in jerks and starts, and in the field beyond, outside the castle, were several hundred riders. When the wind blew, it lifted their banners, and she trembled in relief at the sight of the leaping trout of River Run. Edmure. It was 2 hours before he saw fit to come to her. By then the castle rang to the sound of noisy reunions, as men embraced the women and children they had left behind. 3 ravens had risen from the rookery, black wings beating at the air as they took flight. Catelyn watched them from her father's balcony. She had washed her hair, changed her clothes, and prepared herself for her brother's reproaches, but even so, the waiting was hard. When at last she heard sounds outside her door, she sat and folded her hands in her lap. Dried red mud spattered Edmure's boots, greaves, and surcoat. To look at him, you would never know he had won his battle. He was thin and drawn, with pale cheeks, unkempt beard, and 2 bright eyes. "Edmure," Catelyn said, worried, "you look unwell. Has something happened? Have the Lannisters crossed the river?" "I threw them back. Lord Tywin, Gregor Clegane, Adam Marbrand. I turned them away. Stannis, though.
He grimaced. "Stannis? What of Stannis? He lost the battle at King's Landing," Edmure said unhappily. "His fleet was burned. His army routed." A Lannister victory was ill tidings. But Catelyn could not share her brother's obvious dismay. She still had nightmares about the shadow she had seen slide across Renly's tent and the way the blood had come flowing out through the steel of his gorget. Stannis was no more a friend than Lord Tywin.
"You do not understand. Highgarden has declared for Joffrey, Dorne as well, all the south."
His mouth tightened.
"And you see fit to loose the Kingslayer? You had no right."
"I had a mother's right." Her voice was calm, though the news about Highgarden was a savage blow to Rob's hopes. She could not think about that now, though.
"No right," Edmure repeated. "He was Rob's captive, your king's captive, and Rob charged me to keep him safe."
"Brienne will keep him safe." She swore it on her sword.
"Ach, that woman!"
"She will deliver Jaime to King's Landing and bring Arya and Sansa back to us safely.
Cersei will never give them up."
"Not Cersei. Tyrion. He swore it in open court, and the Kingslayer swore it as well."
"Jaime's word is worthless. As for the imp, it said he took an axe in the head during the battle. He'll be dead before your Brienne reaches King's Landing, if she ever does."
"Dead? Could the gods truly be so merciless?" She had made Jaime swear 100 oaths, but it was his brother's promise she had pinned her hopes on. Edmure was blind to her distress.
"Jaime was my charge, and I mean to have him back. I've sent ravens."
"Ravens? To whom? How many?"
"Three," he answered. "So the message will be certain to reach Lord Bolton. By river or road, the way from River Run to King's Landing must needs take them close by Harrenhal."
"Harrenhal?" The very word seemed to darken the room. Horror thickened her voice as she said, "Edmure, do you know what you have done?"
"Have no fear. I left your part out. I wrote that Jaime had escaped, and offered 1,000 dragons for his recapture."
"Worse and worse," Catelyn thought, in despair. "My brother is a fool." Unbidden, unwanted, tears filled her eyes. "If this was an escape," she said softly, "and not an exchange of hostages, why should the Lannisters give my daughters to Brienne?"
"It will never come to that. The Kingslayer will be returned to us. I have made certain of it."
"All you have made certain is that I shall never see my daughters again. Brienne might have gotten him to King's Landing safely, so long as no one was hunting for them. But now—" Catelyn could not go on. "Leave me, Edmure." She had no right to command him, here in the castle that would soon be his, yet her tone would brook no argument.
"Leave me to father and my grief. I have no more to say to you. Go, go!"
All she wanted was to lie down, to close her eyes and sleep, and pray no dreams would come. Arya. Stony Sept was the biggest town Arya had seen since King's Landing, and Harwin said her father had won a famous battle here.
"The Mad King's men had been hunting Robert, trying to catch him before he could rejoin your father," he told her as they rode toward the gate. "He was wounded, being tended by some friends, when Lord Cunnington, the Hand, took the town with a mighty force and started searching house by house. Before they could find him there, Lord Eddard and your grandfather came down on the town and stormed the walls. Lord Cunnington fought back fierce. They battled in the streets and alleys, even on the rooftops, and all the septons rang their bells so the small folk would know to lock their doors. Robert came out of hiding to join the fight when the bells began to ring. He slew 6 men that day, they say. One was Miles Mouton, a famous knight who had been Prince Rhaegar's squire. He would have slain the Hand, too, but the battle never brought them together. Cunnington wounded your grandfather Tully sore, though, and killed Sir Dennis Aaron, the Darling of the Vale, but when he saw the day was lost, he flew off as fast as the griffins on his shield. The Battle of the Bells, they called it after. Robert always said, your father won it, not him. More recent battles had been fought here as well, Arya thought from the look of the place. The town gates were made of raw new wood. Outside, the walls a pile of charred planks remained to tell what had happened to the old ones. Stony Sept was closed up tight, but when the captain of the gate saw who they were, he opened a sally port for them. "How are you fixed for food?" Tom asked as they entered. "Not so bad as we were. The huntsman brought in a flock of sheep, and there's been some trading across the Blackwater. The harvest wasn't burned south of the river. Course, there's plenty want to take what we got. Wolves one day, mummers the next. Them that's not looking for food are looking for plunder, or women to rape. And them that's not out for gold or wenches are looking for the bloody Kingslayer. Talk is, he slipped right through Lord Edmure's fingers."
"Lord Edmure?" Lem frowned. "Is Lord Oster dead, then?"
"Dead or dying. Think Lannister might be making for the Blackwater?"
"Huh? It's the quickest way to King's Landing, the huntsman swears."
The captain did not wait for an answer.
"He took his dogs out for a sniff round. If Sir Jamie's hereabouts, they'll find him. I've seen them dogs rip bears apart. Think they'll like the taste of lion blood?"
"A chewed-up corpse is no good to no one," said Lem. "The huntsman bloody well knows that, too.
When the Westermen came through, they raped the huntsman's wife and sister, put his crops to the torch, ate off his sheep, and killed the other half for spite. Killed six dogs, too, and threw their carcasses down his well. A chewed-up corpse would be plenty good enough for him, I'd say. Me as well."
"It best not," said Lem. "That's all I've got to say. It best not, and you're a bloody fool." Arya rode between Harwin and Angai as the outlaws moved down the streets where her father had once fought. She could see the sept on its hill, and below it a stout, strong holdfast of grey stone that looked much too small for such a big town. But every third house they passed was a blackened shell, and she saw no people. "Are all the town folk dead?" "Only shy," Angoy pointed out two bowmen on a roof, and some boys with sooty faces crouched in the rubble of an alehouse. Farther on, a baker threw open a shuttered window and shouted down to Lem. The sound of his voice brought more people out of hiding, and Stony Sept slowly seemed to come to life around them. In the market square at the town's heart stood a fountain in the shape of a leaping trout spouting water into a shallow pool. Women were filling pails and flagons there. A few feet away, a dozen iron cages hung from creaking wooden posts.
Crow cages, Arya knew.
The crows were mostly outside the cages, splashing in the water or perched atop the bars. Inside were men. Lem reined up, scowling.
What's this now?
Justice, answered a woman at the fountain.
What, did you run short of hemp and rope?
Was this done at Sir Wilbert's decree? Asked Tom. A man laughed bitterly.
Huh? The lions killed Sir Wilbert a year ago. His sons are all off with a young wolf getting fat in the west. You think they give a damn for the likes of us? It was a mad huntsman caught these wolves.
Wolves? Arya went cold. Rob's men and my father's. She felt drawn toward the cages. The bars allowed so little room that prisoners could neither sit nor turn. They stood naked, exposed to sun and wind and rain. The first three cages held dead men. Carrion crows had eaten out their eyes, yet the empty sockets seemed to follow her. The fourth man in the row stirred as she passed. Around his mouth, his ragged beard was thick with blood and flies. They exploded when he spoke, buzzing around his head.
Water!
The word was a croak.
Please! Water!
The man in the next cage opened his eyes at the sound.
Here! He said. Here! Me!
An old man he was. His beard was grey, and his scalp was bald and mottled brown with age.
There was another dead man beyond the old one, a big red-bearded man with a rotting grey bandage covering his left ear and part of his temple. But the worst thing was between his legs, where nothing remained but a crusted brown hole crawling with maggots. Farther down was a fat man. The crow cage was so cruelly narrow it was hard to see how they'd ever gotten him inside. The iron dug painfully into his belly, squeezing bulges out between the bars. Long days, baking in the sun, had burned him a painful red from head to heel. When he shifted his weight, the cage creaked and swayed, and Arya could see pale white stripes where the bars had shielded his flesh from the sun. "Whose men were you?" she asked them. At the sound of her voice, the fat man opened his eyes. The skin around them was so red, they looked like boiled eggs floating in a dish of blood.
"Water! A drink!"
"Whose?" she said again.
"Pay them no mind, boy," the townsman told her. "They're none of your concern. Ride on by."
"What did they do?" she asked him.
"They put 8 people to the sword at Tumbler's Falls," he said. "They wanted the Kingslayer, but he wasn't there, so they did some rape and murder."
He jerked a thumb toward the corpse with maggots where his manhood ought to be.
"That one there did the raping. Now move along."
"A swallow," the fat man called down. "Have mercy, boy, a swallow."
The old one slid an arm up to grasp the bars. The motion made his cage swing violently.
"Water,"
gasped the one with the flies in his beard. She looked at their filthy hair and scraggly beards and reddened eyes, at their dry, cracked, bleeding lips. "Wolves," she thought again, "like me. Was this her pack? How could they be Rob's men?" She wanted to hit them. She wanted to hurt them. She wanted to cry. They all seemed to be looking at her, the living and the dead alike. The old man had squeezed 3 fingers out between the bars.
"Water,"
he said.
"Water."
Arya swung down from her horse. "They can't hurt me. They're dying." She took her cup from her bedroll and went to the fountain.
"What do you think you're doing, boy?"
the townsman snapped.
"They're no concern of yours."
She raised the cup to the fish's mouth. The water splashed across her fingers and down her sleeve, but Arya did not move until the cup was brimming over. When she turned back toward the cages, the townsman moved to stop her.
"You get away from them, boy."
"She's a girl," said Harwin. "Leave her be."
"Aye," said Lem. "Lord Beric don't hold with gauging men to die of thirst. Why don't you hang 'em decent?" "There was nothing decent about them things they did at Tumbler's Falls," the townsman growled right back at him.
The bars were too narrow to pass a cup through, but Harwin and Gendry offered her a leg up. She planted a foot in Harwin's cupped hands, vaulted onto Gentry's shoulders, and grabbed the bars on top of the cage. The fat man turned his face up and pressed his cheek to the iron, and Arya poured the water over him. He sucked at it eagerly and let it run down over his head and cheeks and hands, and then licked the dampness off the bars. He would have licked Arya's fingers if she hadn't snatched them back. By the time she served the other two the same, a crowd had gathered to watch her.
"The Mad Hunchman will hear of this," a man threatened. "He won't like it. No, he won't."
"He'll like this even less, then." Angai strung his longbow, slid an arrow from his quiver, knocked, drew, loosed. The fat man shuddered as the shaft drove up between his chins, but the cage would not let him fall. 2 more arrows ended the other 2 Northmen. The only sound in the market square was the splash of falling water and the buzzing of flies. Velar Magullis, Arya thought. On the east side of the market square stood a modest inn with whitewashed walls and broken windows. Half its roof had burned off recently, but the hole had been patched over. Above the door hung a wooden shingle painted as a peach, with a big bite taken out of it. They dismounted at the stables, sitting catty-corner, and Greenbeard bellowed for grooms. The buxom red-haired innkeep howled with pleasure at the sight of them, then promptly set to tweaking them.
Greenbeard, is it? Or Greybeard? Mother, take mercy. When did you get so old? Lem, is that you? Still wearing the same ratty cloak, are you? I know why you never wash it, I do. You're afraid all the piss will wash out, and we'll see you're really a knight of the King's Guard. And Thomas Sevens, you randy old goat, you come to see that son of yours. Well, you're too late. He's off riding with that bloody huntsman. And don't tell me it's not yours.
He hasn't got my voice, Tom protested weakly.
He's got your nose, though, aye, and t'other parts as well, to hear the girls talk.
She spied Gendry then, and pinched him on the cheek.
Look at this fine young ox. Wait till Alice sees those arms. Oh, and he blushes like a maid, too. Well, Alice will fix that for you, boy. See if you don't.
Arya had never seen Gendry turn so red.
Pansy, you leave the bull alone. He's a good lad, said Tom Sevenstrings. All we need from you is safe beds for a night.
Speak for yourself, singer. Angai slid his arm around a strapping young serving girl as freckly as he was.
Beds we got, said Redhead Tansy. There's never been no lack of beds at the Peach, but you'll all climb in a tub first. Last time you lot stayed under my roof, you left your fleas behind.
She poked Greenbeard in the chest.
And yours was green, too. You want food? Or if you can spare it, we won't say no,
Tom conceded.
Now when did you ever say no to anything, Tom?
Huh? The woman hooted.
I'll roast some mutton for your friends, and an old dry rat for you. It's more than you deserve. But if you gargle me a song or three, might be I'll weaken. I always pity the afflicted. Come on, come on. Cass, Lanner, put some kettles on. Jazeen, help me get the clothes off them. We'll need to boil those, too.
She made good on all her threats. Arya tried to tell them that she'd been bathed twice at Acorn Hall not a fortnight past, but the red-haired woman was having none of it. Two serving wenches carried her up the stairs bodily, arguing about whether she was a girl or a boy. The one called Helly won, so the other had to fetch the hot water and scrub Arya's back with a stiff, bristly brush that almost took her skin off. Then they stole all the clothes that Lady Smallwood had given her and dressed her up like one of Sansa's dolls, in linen and lace. But at least, when they were done, she got to go down and eat. As she sat in the common room in her stupid girl clothes, Arya remembered what Syrio Forel had told her, the trick of looking and seeing what was there. When she looked, she saw more serving wenches than any inn could want, and most of them young and comely. And come evenfall, lots of men started coming and going at the Peach. They did not linger long in the common room, not even when Tom took out his wood harp and began to sing Six Maids in a Pool. The wooden steps were old and steep, and creaked something fierce whenever one of the men took a girl upstairs. "I bet this is a brothel," she whispered to Gendry.
"You don't even know what a brothel is."
"I do so," she insisted. "It's like an inn, with girls." He was turning red again.
"What are you doing here, then?" he demanded. "A brothel's no fit place for no bloody high-born lady. Everybody knows that."
One of the girls sat down on the bench beside him.
"Who's a high-born lady? The little skinny one?"
She looked at Arya and laughed.
"I'm a king's daughter myself."
Arya knew she was being mocked.
"You are not." "Well, I might be."
When the girl shrugged, her gown slipped off one shoulder.
"They say King Robert fucked my mother when he hid here back before the battle. Not that he didn't have all the other girls, too, but Leslyn says he liked my ma the best."
The girl did have hair like the old king's, Arya thought. A great thick mop of it, as black as coal. That doesn't mean anything, though. Gendry has the same kind of hair, too. Lots of people have black hair.
"I'm named Bella," the girl told Gendry. "For the battle, I bet I could ring your bell, too. You want to?"
"No," he said gruffly.
"I bet you do." She ran a hand along his arm. I don't cost nothing to friends of Thoris and the Lightning Lord. No, I said.
Gendry rose abruptly and stalked away from the table out into the night. Bella turned to Arya.
Don't he like girls?
Arya shrugged.
He's just stupid. He likes to polish helmets and beat on swords with hammers. Oh.
Bella tugged her gown back over her shoulder and went to talk with Jack Bilucky. Before long, she was sitting in his lap, giggling and drinking wine from his cup. Greenbeard had two girls, one on each knee. Angai had vanished with his freckle-faced wench, and Lem was gone as well. Tom Sevenstring sat by the fire, singing The Maids That Bloom in Spring. Arya sipped at the cup of watered wine the red-haired woman had allowed her, listening. Across the square the dead men were rotting in their crow cages, but inside the peach everyone was jolly, except it seemed to her that some of them were laughing too hard, somehow. It would have been a good time to sneak away and steal a horse, but Arya couldn't see how that would help her. She could only ride as far as the city gates.
That captain would never let me pass, and if he did, Harwin would come after me, or that huntsman with his dogs.
She wished she had her map, so she could see how far Stony Sept was from Riverrun. By the time her cup was empty, Arya was yawning. Gendry hadn't come back. Tom Sevenstrings was singing Two Hearts That Beat as One, and kissing a different girl at the end of every verse. In the corner, by the window, Lem and Harwin sat talking to red-haired Tansy in low voices.
"Spent the night in Jamie's cell," she heard the woman say. "Her and this other wench, the one who slew Renly, all three of them together. And come the morn, Lady Catelyn cut him loose for love."
She gave a throaty chuckle.
"It's not true," Arya thought. "She never would."
She felt sad and angry and lonely all at once. An old man sat down beside her.
"Well, aren't she a pretty little peach?"
His breath smelled near as foul as a dead man in their cages, and his little pig eyes were crawling up and down her.
"Does my sweet peach have a name?"
For half a heartbeat she forgot who she was supposed to be. She wasn't any peach, but she couldn't be Arya Stark either. Not here with some smelly drunk she did not know.
She's my sister."
Gendry put a heavy hand on the old man's shoulder and squeezed.
"Leave her be."
The man turned, spoiling for a quarrel. But when he saw Gendry's size, he thought better of it.
"Your sister, is she? What kind of brother are you? I'd never bring no sister of mine to the beach. That I wouldn't."
He got up from the bench and moved off, muttering, in search of a new friend. "Why did you say that?" Arya hopped to her feet. "You're not my brother."
"That's right," he said angrily. "I'm too bloody low-born to be kin to my lady, I."
Arya was taken back by the fury in his voice. "That's not the way I meant it."
"Yes, it is."
He sat down on the bench, cradling a cup of wine between his hands.
"Go away. I want to drink this wine in peace. Then maybe I'll go and find that black-haired girl and ring her bell for her." "But I said, go away, my lady."
Arya whirled and left him there. A stupid, bull-headed, bastard boy, that's all he is. He could ring all the bells he wanted. It was nothing to her. Their sleeping room was at the top of the stairs under the eaves. Maybe the peach had no lack of beds, but there was only one to spare for the likes of them. It was a big bed, though. It filled the whole room, just about, and the musty straw-stuffed mattress looked large enough for all of them. Just now, though, she had it to herself. Her real clothes were hanging from a peg on the wall, between Gendry's stuff and Lem's. Arya took off the linen and lace, pulled her tunic over her head, climbed up into the bed, and burrowed under the blankets. "Queen Cersei," she whispered into the pillow. "King Joffrey, Sir Ilion, Sir Meryn, Dunson, Raff and Polliver, the Tickler, the Hound, and Sir Gregor the Mountain." She liked to mix up the order of the name sometimes. It helped her remember who they were and what they'd done.
"Maybe some of them are dead," she thought.
Maybe there are iron cages somewhere, and the crows are picking out their eyes.
Sleep came as quick as she closed her eyes. She dreamed of wolves that night, stalking through a wet wood with the smell of rain and rot and blood thick in the air. Only they were good smells in the dream, and Arya knew she had nothing to fear. She was strong and swift and fierce, and her pack was all around her, her brothers and sisters. They ran down a frightened horse together, tore its throat out, and feasted. And when the moon broke through the clouds, she threw back her head and howled. But when the day came, she woke to the barking of dogs. Arya sat up, yawning. Gendry was stirring on her left, and Lem Lemoncloak snoring loudly to her right. But the baying outside all but drowned them out. There must be 50 dogs out there. She crawled from under the blankets and hopped over Lem, Tom, and Jackby Lucky to the window. When she opened the shutters wide, wind and wet and cold all came flooding in together. The day was grey and overcast. Down below in the square, the dogs were barking, running in circles, growling and howling. There was a pack of them, great black mastiffs and lean wolfhounds, and black and white sheepdogs, and kinds Arya did not know, shaggy, brindled beasts with long yellow teeth. Between the inn and the fountain, a dozen riders sat astride their horses, watching the townsman open the fat man's cage and tug his arm until his swollen corpse spilled out onto the ground. The dogs were at him at once, tearing chunks of flesh off his bones. Arya heard one of the riders laugh.
"Here's a new castle, you bloody Lannister bastard," he said. "A little snug for the likes of you, but we'll squeeze in, never fret."
Beside him a prisoner sat sullen, with coils of hempen rope tight around his wrists. Some of the townsfolk were throwing dung at him, but he never flinched.
"You'll rot in them cages!" his captor was shouting. "The crows will be picking out your eyes while we're spending all that good Lannister gold of yours. And when them crows are done, we'll send what's left of you to your bloody brother, though I doubt he'll know you."
The noise had woken half the peach. Gendry squeezed into the window beside Arya, and Tom stepped up behind them, naked as his name day.
"What's all the bloody shouting?" Lem complained from bed. "A man's trying to get some bloody sleep."
"Where's Greenbeard?" Tom asked him.
"A bed with Tansy," Lem said. "Why?"
"Best find him. Archer, too. The mad huntsman's come back, with another man for the cages."
"Lannister," said Arya. "I heard him say Lannister."
"Have they caught the Kingslayer?" Gendry wanted to know.
Down in the square, a thrown stone caught the captive on the cheek, turning his head. Not the Kingslayer, Arya thought, when she saw his face. The gods had heard her prayers, after all. John. Ghost was gone when the wildlings led their horses from the cave. Did he understand about Castle Black? John took a breath of the crisp morning air and allowed himself to hope. The eastern sky was pink near the horizon and pale grey higher up. The sword of the morning still hung in the south, the bright white star in its hilt blazing like a diamond in the dawn, but the blacks and greys of the darkling forest were turning once again to greens and golds, reds and russets. And above, the soldier pines and oaks and ash and sentinels stood the wall. The ice, pale and glimmering beneath the dust and dirt that pocked its surface. The Magnar sent a dozen men riding west and a dozen more east to climb the highest hills they could find and watch for any sign of rangers in the wood or riders on the high ice. The Thens carried bronze-banded war horns to give warning should the watch be sighted. The other wildlings fell in behind Jarl, John, and Ygritte with the rest. This was to be the young raider's hour of glory. The wall was often said to stand 700 feet high, but Jarl had found a place where it was both higher and lower. Before them the ice rose sheer from out of the trees like some immense cliff, crowned by wind-carved battlements that loomed at least 800 feet high, perhaps 900 in spots. But that was deceptive, John realized, as they drew closer. Brandon the Builder had laid his huge foundation blocks along the heights whenever feasible, and hereabouts the hills rose wild and rugged. He'd once heard his uncle Benjamin say that the wall was a sword east of Castle Black, but a snake to the west. It was true. Sweeping in over one huge humped hill, the ice dipped down into a valley, climbed the knife edge of a long granite ridgeline for a league or more, ran along a jagged crest, dipped again into a valley deeper still, and then rose higher and higher, leaping from hill to hill as far as the eye could see into the mountainous west. Jarl had chosen to assault the stretch of ice along the ridge. Here, though the top of the wall loomed 800 feet above the forest floor, a good third of that height was earth and stone, rather than ice. The slope was too steep for their horses, almost as difficult to scramble as the fist of the first man, but still vastly easier to ascend than the sheer vertical face of the wall itself. And the ridge was densely wooded as well, offering easy concealment. Once, brothers in black had gone out every day with axes to cut back the encroaching trees, but those days were long past, and here the forest grew right up to the ice. The day promised to be damp and cold, and damper and colder by the wall, beneath those tons of ice. The closer they got, the more the Thens held back. They have never seen the wall before, not even the Magna, John realized. It frightens them. In the Seven Kingdoms it was said that the wall marked the end of the world. That is true for them as well. It was all in where you stood. And where do I stand? John did not know. To stay with Ygritte, he would need to become a wildling, heart and soul. If he abandoned her, to return to his duty, the Magna might cut her heart out. And if he took her with him, assuming she would go, which was far from certain, well, he could scarcely bring her back to Castle Black to live among the brothers. A deserter and a wildling could expect no welcome anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms. We could go look for Gendel's children, I suppose, though they'd be more like to eat us than to take us in. The wall did not awe Jarl's raiders, John saw. They have done this before, every man of them. Jarl called out names when they dismounted, beneath the ridge, and 11 gathered round him. All were young. The oldest could not have been more than 25, and 2 of the 10 were younger than John. Everyone was lean and hard, though. They had a look of sinewy strength that reminded him of Stone Snake, the brother the half-hand had sent off afoot when Rattleshirt was hunting them. In the very shadow of the wall the wildlings made ready, winding thick coils of hempen rope around one shoulder and down across their chests, and lacing on queer boots of supple doeskin. The boots had spikes jutting from the toes, iron for Jarl and 2 others, bronze for some, but most often jagged bone. Small stone-headed hammers hung from one hip, a leathern bag of stakes from the other. Their ice axes were antlers with sharpened tines, bound to wooden hafts with strips of hide. The 11 climbers sorted themselves into 3 teams of 4. Jarl himself made the 12th man. "Mans promises swords for every man of the first team to reach the top," he told them, his breath misting in the cold air. "Southern swords of castle forged steel, and your name in the song he'll make of this, that too. What more could a free man ask? Up, and the others take the hindmost!" The others take them all, thought John, as he watched them scramble up the steep slope of the ridge and vanish beneath the trees. It would not be the first time the wildlings had scaled the wall, not even the 101st. The patrols stumbled on climbers 2 or 3 times a year, and rangers sometimes came on the broken corpses of those who had fallen. Along the east coast, the raiders most often built boats to slip across the Bay of Seals. In the west, they would descend into the black depths of the gorge to make their way around the Shadow Tower, but in between, the only way to defeat the wall was to go over it, and many a raider had. Fewer come back, though, he thought, with a certain grim pride. Climbers must, of necessity, leave their mounts behind, and many younger, greener raiders began by taking the first horses they found. Then a hue and cry would go up, ravens would fly, and as often as not, the Night's Watch would hunt them down and hang them before they could get back with their plunder and stolen women. Jarl would not make that mistake, John knew. But he wondered about Styr. The Magnor is a ruler, not a raider. He may not know how the game is played.
There they are,
Ygritte said, and John glanced up to see the first climber emerge above the treetops. It was Jarl. He had found a sentinel tree that leaned against the wall, and led his men up the trunk to get a quicker start. The wood should never have been allowed to creep so close. They're 300 feet up, and they haven't touched the ice itself yet. He watched the wildling move carefully from wood to wall, hacking out a handhold with short, sharp blows of his ice axe, then swinging over. The rope around his waist tied him to the second man in line, still edging up the tree. Step by slow step, Jarl moved higher, kicking out toe holes with his spiked boots when there were no natural ones to be found. When he was 10 feet above the sentinel, he stopped upon a narrow, icy ledge, slung his axe from his belt, took out his hammer, and drove an iron stake into a cleft. The second man moved onto the wall behind him, while the third was scrambling to the top of the tree. The other two teams had no happily placed trees to give them a leg up, and before long the Thens were wondering whether they had gotten lost climbing the ridge. Jarl's party were all on the wall and 80 feet up before the leading climbers from the other groups came into view. The teams were spaced a good 20 yards apart. Jarl's four were in the center. To the right of them was a team led by Grig the Goat, whose long blonde braid made him easy to spot from below. To the left, a very thin man named Eric led the climbers.
"So slow,"
the Magnar complained loudly, as he watched them edge their way upward.
"Has he forgotten the crews? He should climb faster, afore we are discovered."
John had to hold his tongue. He remembered the Skirling Pass all too well, and the moonlight climb he'd made with Stone Snake. He had swallowed his heart a half a dozen times that night, and by the end his arms and legs had been aching and his fingers were half frozen. And that was stone, not ice. Stone was solid. Ice was treacherous stuff at the best of times, and on a day like this, when the wall was weeping, the warmth of a climber's hand might be enough to melt it. The huge blocks could be frozen rock hard inside, but their outer surface would be slick, with runnels of water trickling down, and patches of rotten ice where the air had gotten in. Whatever else the wildlings are, they're brave. All the same, John found himself hoping that Styr's fears prove well-founded. If the gods are good, a patrol will chance by and put an end to this. "No wall can keep you safe," his father told him once, as they walked the walls of Winterfell. "A wall is only as strong as the men who defend it. The wildlings might have 120 men, but 4 defenders would be enough to see them off, with a few well-placed arrows and perhaps a pail of stones." No defenders appeared, however. Not 4, not even 1. The sun climbed the sky, and the wildlings climbed the wall. Jarl's 4 remained well ahead till noon, when they hit a patch of bad ice. Jarl had looped his rope around a wind-carved pinnace, and was using it to support his weight, when the whole jagged thing suddenly crumbled and came crashing down, and him with it. Chunks of ice as big as a man's head bombarded the 3 below, but they clung to the handholds, and the stakes held, and Jarl jerked to a sudden halt at the end of the rope. By the time his team had recovered from that mischance, Grig the Goat had almost drawn even with them. Eric's 4 remained well behind. The face where they were climbing looked smooth and unpitted, covered with a sheet of ice melt that glistened wetly where the sun brushed it. Grig's section was darker to the eye, with more obvious features, long horizontal ledges where a block had been imperfectly positioned atop the block below, cracks and crevices, even chimneys along the vertical joins, where wind and water had eaten holes large enough for a man to hide in. Giles soon